this is Johnny Walker, and you're listening to An American Life, The Bruce Springsteen Story. Over the next 3 weeks here on Radio 2, we're going to be hearing from the man himself, the boss, on his life and music. Bruce Springsteen has spoken exclusively and at length to create a unique and in-depth portrait. This three-part series also features contributions from those closest to Springsteen and his many admirers in the music world who give us their insight into his appeal, his achievements, and his legacy.
He's a great storyteller. I think his songs are real and they're very cinematic. They're very slice of life.
I think Bruce Springsteen is kind of the poet laureate of American music, really. He very much said, "I am of the American urban experience."
It was the fundamental way that I connected myself to the world. It's still a tremendous source of inspiration for me.
It was a very slow climb up. We really built our audience one person at a time.
It was a shock to me that there were 23,000 people who I did not know who had gone out and got the music.
He's totally, utterly non-J-Lo, I'm very pleased to say. He's one of those people who walks it like he talks it.
You strip away the specifics of New Jersey. What he's talking about is trying to fashion something meaningful out of being a working-class guy.
Everyone has memories that they live within you. They are an essential part of who you are and that reveal to you what it meant to be alive. That's the writer's job. The writer collects and creates those moments.
In 1974, the rock critic and future Springsteen manager John Landau wrote, "I've seen rock and roll future, and its name is Bruce Springsteen."
The screen door slams, Mary's dress waves. Like a vision, she dances across the porch as the radio plays.
For once, outrageous hype would be borne out by the events that followed. The next year, Springsteen released his third album, Born to Run, and immediately established himself as one of the pivotal figures in American music. His romanticism has never blinded him to the darker side of life. And the mixture has captivated rock fans the world over for more than a quarter of a century.
The music gets in and messes with your spirit and messes with the deepest parts of you, and also it gets a hold of you physically, you know, which is pretty unusual. There's not that many things that do that. When people come to the show, and it's been part of rock and roll since the Bill Haley concert where the guy stood up and, you know, threw the first chair across the room or something. You know, it's just a part of, like, I'm out of here, you know, meaning I'm out of myself. it's like the jail door of you swings open for a few minutes and you get out. And I think that that experience is something that people seek at rock and roll shows and elsewhere, you know. We play with that idea a lot on stage, and we half joke with it and we're half sort of serious about it, so.
But the Bruce Springsteen story really starts in the small New Jersey town of Freehold.
Dirty old street house, slushed up in the rain and snow.
The place where he first saw Elvis on TV, and as this song, The Wish, tells, where he persuaded his mother to buy him a guitar.
Little boy and his mind shivering outside, run down music store window.
Springsteen was born in September 1949, the son of a factory worker and a secretary, and all the signs were that he would follow his parents and his peers into a similar life, decent but undistinguished. That guitar, however, opened a door into another very different world.
The minute I began to sing and I went down to the Elks Club, and I picked up my guitar. I remember I sang Twist and Shout. I felt different, you know, very different.
On stage with Bruce that night in 1965 were the Castiles, a band he joined after their leader, George Theise, came round to date his older sister. They were also the recipients of Springsteen's first ever song, Baby I. Reputedly written in the car on the way to the recording session in 1966.
Well, it was a remarkable time looking back. I don't think it's happened before or since.
Stephen Van Zandt, the man now known to millions as Silvio Dante from TV series The Sopranos, also known as Little Stephen.
We had our own venues. There was high schools he played. There was beach clubs. There was the TV show called Hullabaloo had clubs. There was a teenage nightclub called Les Teen Des Vues. There was VFW halls, union halls. Just dozens and dozens and dozens of places to play as a teenage rock and roll band, which I'm sure don't exist anymore. So we were very lucky to be in that generation.
Like most teenage bands, the Castiles didn't last long, and the young Bruce found himself rattling through a series of other groups, most notably Steel Mill, where he played hard and heavy rock music, like this track, The Wind and the Rain. The classic local band, huge at home, unknown everywhere else. Steel Mill eventually foundered after an unsuccessful trip to the West Coast. And at the age of 19, Springsteen found himself back where he started from, 15 miles east of Freehold, in the resort of Asbury Park.
The one thing that was unique about the town at the time was there was a club that was open from 8 to 5 in the morning where there wasn't any booze served and it was just kids, you know. And because it was open 2 or 3 hours after the bars closed, all musicians, after they finished their regular gigs at the bars, they would come down and everybody would play.
The wind and rain slashing at my window pane. Lightning's flashing, looks like the sky's gone insane. And it seems like you have lied again. And now I'm left with the wind and the rain.
It was late 60s, a place called the Upstage, and it was a tremendous meeting place for both local musicians and musicians who simply came into the area to work over the course of the summer. It was really a shock. I can remember walking in and I felt like I'd really discovered something. It was an amazing place simply to exist. Basically, it was how I began to play with many of the fellas that I'd play with for a long, long part of my career.
One of those fellows was Stephen Van Zandt.
I was on the Jersey Shore, a place called Middletown, which is about, 20 minutes from the ocean. Then there's a triangle down south to Asbury Park, which was about 30 miles or so. And then another 20 miles west to Freehold, where Bruce was from. And then back up north to where we were. So there's a sort of a triangle there, which made up what they call the Jersey Shore.
Gary Tallon.
He was playing at a place called the Upstage Club, and the dance floor was packed, and I turned my chair around to check this new guy out, and I thought he was great, and at that point, the dance floor cleared, so it was just kind of me sitting there looking at him, and he saw me, and he thought I was, like, giving him a bad vibe or something, so his first impression of me was he didn't like me. Who's this guy?
There was maybe 10 bands or so, 10 or 12 bands that popped up as part of the post-British invasion thing, where February 8th, 1964, there was nobody in a band, and February 10th, everyone was in a band, because on February 9th, the Beatles played Ed Sullivan.
Groups like Dr. Zoom and the Sonic Boom and the rather more prosaic Bruce Springsteen Band laid the foundations of the future E Street Band. But although their mix of rock, R&B and soul music was hugely popular on the Jersey Shore, Bruce had something else in mind.
I began to write music that would not have worked in a club. It required too much attention and too much listening and a certain kind of focus. Bars were for something else, you know. But I felt like if I was going to take a real shot at it, I was going to have to do something that was going to be very distinctive and original. And I think I wanted the independence, I wanted the individuality of the solo career. And I just sat in my room and I just began to write. That's when I began to write some of the initial songs, probably for Greetings from Asbury Park. And I was living in Asbury, above this little beauty salon, and it was out of business, and I had an old piano in the back of it. And at night I'd go down and sit with the hair dryer, amidst all the hair dryers. And I wrote a bunch of the songs from that album around that time. in a way that I hadn't before. And it was the only thing that I was doing. I wasn't working in the bars at the time. I was strictly working on my writing and hoping that I was going to get somewhere, find somebody who was interested in it.
That person turned out to be John Hammond at Columbia Records, the man who discovered Bob Dylan and Billie Holiday.
Bruce Springsteen, Columbia Pop Audition, job number 79682, Mary Queen of Arkansas, take one.
Bruce had a new manager, the energetic and passionately committed Mike Appel, who hustled a meeting with the legendary record man.
Mary Queen of Arkansas, it's not too early for dreaming.
It was exciting to be there with him. I knew a lot about him and the work that he'd done and the people he'd discovered and his importance that he'd played in music, and it was very exciting to just feel like you were worth his time. That was something that meant a lot to me, I think. No matter what had happened, feeling that even if it was just for this particular night. He was very encouraging, you know, but you never know until you know what's going to happen. But to just simply have been there in that room with him at the board was one of my greatest recording experiences.
Mary, my queen, your blows for freedom are the same.
It was old-fashioned, sort of. I mean, everybody was in ties and shirts, you know. And you hit the button, and off you go, you know. And I was excited. I felt I'd written some good songs, and I felt that this was my shot. I had nothing to lose, and I felt like I was like the beginning of something. I was hoping it was the beginning of something, not the end, I guess.
Hey, bus driver, keep the change. Bless your children, give them names. Don't trust men who walk with canes. Drink this, and in a week you'll have wings on your feet. Broadway Mary Joan Fontaine, advertiser on a downtown train. Oh, Christmas Crier, Buster Kane.
Does this bus stop at 82nd Street from Bruce Springsteen's 1972 debut album for Columbia, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey. But John Hammond had seen only one version of what Bruce Springsteen could be. Bruce had other plans.
I wanted a band at that time because I'd played with a group for a long time, and I knew that a big part of my abilities were when it came time to present what I was doing was going to be able to use a band to do that.
Well, I stood stone like at midnight, suspended in my masquerade, and I combed my hair till it was just right, and commanded the night brigade. I was open to pain and cross.
Here's little Stephen.
I fully consciously intended to make Bruce Springsteen the biggest star in the world if I could. I felt he deserved it. I felt he was unique, something that the industry needed and that the history of rock and roll needed, someone who had a sense of tradition. That wasn't really the way people were thinking at that point. It was glam and disco and theatricality and that really David Bowie had introduced. And I felt Bruce was very much not that.
The flag of piracy flew from my mast. My sails were set wing to wing.
I handed the record in, it was finished. And Clive Davis sent it back, says there's no singles. You know, it's all singles. So I'm in the music business now, you know. So, but I said, well, okay, you know, I'll write some.
She was blinded by a light. Oh, cut loose like a deuce, another runner in the night.
It was an odd moment there because he ended up getting signed as a solo artist, which was a bit weird for me. You know, I didn't really relate to solo artists. I still really don't. There were bands over here and solo artists over there, and then end up Bruce Springsteen and E Street Band somewhere in the middle, you know. So he found a way to sort of be the best of both worlds. But at the time, there was no both worlds. You were a band, or you were a singer-songwriter, solo artist coming from the folk world, which is how he got signed, which was an odd thing for me and those of us who knew him, because we were the two or three of the big local rock and roll guys, guitar players. We were the Jeff Becks and Jimmy Pages or wannabes, you know. So for him to be signed as a solo folk artist was just a bit strange, and first record reflected that sort of bizarre combination of things.
Crazy Jane and a Mission Man were back in the alley trading hands. Long came Wild Billy with his friend G-Man, all rooted up for Saturday night. Well, Billy slammed on his coast of briefs and said anybody would want to go on up to Greasy Lake. It's about a mile down on the dark side of Route 88. I got a bottle of rose, but let's try it. We'll pick up Hazy Davy and Killer Joe, and I'll take you all out to where the gypsy angels go. They feel like life. Ooh, and they dance like spirits in the night.
All night.
Yeah, the night.
All night.
Oh, you don't know what they can do to you.
Another crucial component of the burgeoning E Street Band was saxophonist Clarence Clemons.
Went back home and it might have been the fall or something. I sat on the beach. I think I wrote "Spirit in the Night," "Blinded by the Light." I moved back a little bit into the R&B that I'd been working on earlier, and so I said, "Hey, you know, I'm trying to find that sax player." I'd met him while I was playing in Asbury, and he was hard to find, which wasn't that uncommon in those days. You'd see people, and then you wouldn't see them, and you couldn't find them. They didn't have any place they were living. I didn't have any place I was living. You know, there was no one had addresses, and so you had to, sometimes months would go by before you saw that person and was able to catch them again, and that's sort of what happened to him. And I got a hold of him, and he came in and played on those two songs from that record, so that's how we sort of filled the band out at that time.
Well, now Hazy Davy got really hurt. He ran into the lake in just his socks and a shirt. Me and Crazy Janie was making love in the dirt, singing our birthday songs. Janie said it was time to go, so we closed our eyes and said goodbye to Gypsy Angel Row. Felt so right. Together we move like spirits in the night.
All night.
In the night.
All night.
Oh, you don't know what they can do to you. Help spirits in the night.
This is Johnny Walker, and you're listening to An American Life, the Bruce Springsteen Story on BBC Radio 2. Singer and songwriter Thea Gilmore.
I think Bruce Springsteen is an awesome lyricist, but his songs aren't sort of clever or particularly cerebral, but they hit you at an instinctive level, I think. After you listen to a Bruce Springsteen song, you're left feeling like the song has kind of always been there. It's not like you've just heard it, it's like you've heard it 1,000 times before. It's an amazing thing for a writer to do. It's a very difficult thing for a writer to do, to paint such a massive canvas with such, if I say simple, I don't mean simplistic, I just mean sort of simple language that appeals to everybody.
Sparks fly.
By the time of his second album, released in 1973 as The Wild, The Innocent and The E Street Shuffle, Springsteen had refined his tales of New Jersey nightlife to create a compelling portrait of a world which, although fictionalized and romanticized, was still one that his listeners knew, the musicians adding their own distinctive touches, not least accordion player Danny Federici.
The band at that time were folk musicians. I think with the exception of Danny, who'd taken a lot of accordion lessons, there wasn't any real formal training, you know. And people played very, very personally and very eccentrically. And if you listen to those cuts from The Wild and The Innocent, the first record also, and the cuts from that period of time, the band is playing very unusual. It's a little Carney band, you know. You hear the influences, which really Danny had a lot to do with, was the boardwalk, the accordion, and then just the atmosphere from the lyric writing which came out of that particular environment.
Sandy, the fireworks are hailing over Little Eden tonight. Forcing a light and all those stony faces left stranded on this warm July. Down in town the circuits fall a switch, blade lovers so fast, so shiny, so sharp. As the wizards play down on Pinball Way, on the boardwalk way past dark.
Danny Federici.
We did a lot of acoustic stuff in the early days, a lot of radio shows where we couldn't take anything but the accordion, so it was kind of a natural thing. I guess I'm a very feeling player. I can really read a lot. And plus, when you're together with someone for such a long time, you really can feel their energy and you know which way to play.
But live, Bruce and the newly christened E Street Band, named after the address of their rehearsal space, were a completely different proposition. They played incessantly through 1973 and 74, and everywhere they went, the story was the same. Now a major figure at the MTV networks, Bill Flanagan was just one of thousands who came away convinced that he, like John Lando, had seen rock and roll future.
Spread out now, Rosie, doctor, come cut loose her mama's reins. You know playing blind man's love is a little baby's game.
In about 1973 and 74, I was in Providence, a school just outside of Boston, and there was a tremendous amount of talk about this guy who was playing the bar as Bruce Springsteen, and yet I couldn't get a fix on what he was, because somebody would say, it's like the Jay Giles Band, and somebody else would say, oh, he's like John Prine. So I thought, is he a folky? Is he a blues guy? What is it? And I finally went to see him play for $2 at midnight in a college classroom at my school. And kind of, if I hadn't spent $2 on the ticket, probably wouldn't have gone back. Because remember, I was out with my friends. I said, oh, I should go do this. And I said to people, and people thought I was crazy, holy smoke, this is like seeing Elvis Presley before he got signed to RCA. This is like seeing the Beatles at the Cavern Club. I was shaking people going, do you see what we're seeing here? Can you believe it?
He had the songs, he had the band, he had the reputation. All Bruce Springsteen needed now was the record that was going to pull it all together.
In the day we sweated out on the streets of a runaway American dream. At night
On the Run for the first time, I went in to specifically use the studio as a tool and to use it in a way that was unnatural, that was not an attempt to replicate the sound when we played. Both writing it was very difficult, and then recording it and getting a sound that I felt approximated the sound that I wanted was very difficult, and the records began to take a long time. I was striving for something very specific that I didn't know how to get, so I had to spend time in search of it, finding it.
But find it he did. Born to Run was an instant classic, co-produced by John Landau and sounding, in a memorable phrase of the time, like a 1963 Cadillac running on Melted Down Crystals records. Badly Drawn Boys' Damon Goff.
He's always touched on the relationship and the breaking free and finding your feet in life and winning against all the odds and carving a path for yourself, making this crappy old world something good. And that's always been what he's good at. Thunder Road just became the song that represented the moment where I discovered Bruce and discovered music in a different way than I had before that. Bruce came along and it was just different to anything else. It was probably the initial spark of me doing it now, but it wasn't until I was 21, 22 that I even thought about being a singer. Didn't appeal to me, but it must have been some kind of spark going back to 15, 14 year old. So being a loyal person, Thunder Road just became the one that meant something.
Bill Flanagan watched Bruce's momentum build.
With a kilo of graces and the secret places that no more can fill.
Born to Run, the album, certainly brought Bruce to a wider public. There was a real slow build going on. His live shows had been sort of town by town, grabbing people by the neck and winning converts, and he was moving like John the Baptist through the desert, just building a bigger and bigger audience. In the early summer of 75, a few months before Born to Run came out, his first two albums appeared on the charts for the first time, and week by week we're moving up, 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 so that when Born to Run hit, there was a kind of a boiling over waiting to happen, and that album went to number 3, and of course he was on the cover of Time and Newsweek the same week, which was unprecedented, especially in those days. Only the president had a shot at being on those two influential magazines the same week. So suddenly he was famous overnight.
Little Stephen.
At that point, we had a substantial following. We probably could have done a million records worldwide without any radio at that point, which was quite an achievement. At that point, you can make a living. You're in that very, very unique middle, what I call the middle, of which there's virtually doesn't exist. You know, you're either nowhere or you're a success.
The thing he had been building through his live shows was working really, really well, and he would have gotten there anyway. And then he had to contend with a certain amount of suspicion that he was a hype, that he was a media creation, that he was a rock critic's creation.
We actually had such a good reputation live that we could make a living and not only break even, but make a few dollars. Although we had not very much airplay, and then managed to have that first hit single, and damn, we went from 1 million to 3 million just like that, playing arenas everywhere. And once you're selling out arenas, you very much made it. You're there.
The original E Street Band, the one that made the Wild, the Innocent, and the E Street Shuffle, it was a very kind of jazzy group, half black and half white, that was able to bring in bits of sort of the Band and Van Morrison and Dylan and Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry and soul music and put it together in a way that didn't sound like a hodgepodge. It sounded very, very unified, very, very strong. The version of the E Street Band that appeared at the time of Born to Run, where Steve Van Zandt, Max Weinberg, and Roy Bittan came in, was sort of more focused. It was much more, and this is of course also where John Landau came in. We're a rock and roll band, and we're going to make rock and roll music. And we're not going to go off so much into the jazz side or into the folky side. It's going to be right down the middle, but it's going to be the biggest, grandest rock and roll anybody ever made.
As Bruce's profile rose at home, so the pressure for him to expand his audience outside the US increased. Accompanied by former Beatle aide Tony Bramwell, Springsteen and the E Street Band undertook a short tour of Europe, culminating in, to Bruce's mind at least, a disastrous UK show at London's Hammersmith Odeon. It's not a fond memory for little Stephen either.
God, you know, when the first time you travel, it's a shock. I don't know why, at that age, you're trying to relate things to what you know. I guess, you know, you need to find some familiar ground to walk on, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you're going somewhere else, so you would think you'll enjoy the difference. But that's not what happens the first time you travel. I remember us just desperately searching for a hamburger. There was no McDonald's.
Tony Bramwell.
They did the sound check, and after the sound check, Bruce went and wandered around the front of the theatre and saw all these hideous posters, sort of, "Is London ready for Bruce Springsteen?" Really got up his nose. And there was a lack of communication between the whole band and CBS Records at the time. Bruce ripped all the posters down. He just went mad, climbing up the scaffolding, tearing them away. And he badly cut his hand on paper cuts or on the staples that were holding the displays up. But he did the show, and it was brilliant, a wonderful show. But of course, the London audience just sat there, sort of, shows what you can do. They just could not get the atmosphere going that we had in the States. And after the show, there was a party which CBS had, and we all went to it. And after a few minutes, he just said, "I can't take this. Can I go and stay in your house?" So we all piled into the limousines and went back to my house and sat up all night watching videos of James Dean and probably the people at CBS One who weren't at the artist had gone to.
And things were no easier for Springsteen when he got back home. A lawsuit launched after Bruce's decision to change managers from Appel to Landau meant he was prevented from recording for nearly 2 years. When he returned to the studio to make Darkness at the Edge of Town, the relief was palpable.
Darkness, the stakes had changed. They had gotten a lot higher. All of a sudden, I had an audience. Hadn't really had one. Had a small little grassroots audience. The first record sold about 20,000. I remember I asked him, I said, "Mike, he says, how many did we sell?" I said, "About 23,000. And he was disappointed. I said, "We did?" I said, "Who are all those people buying the records out there?" It was a shock to me that there were 23,000 people who I did not know who had gone out and got the music that we made. I felt it was a great success, you know.
Hey, man, you got
then when the third record hit, all of a sudden we had an audience that people took notice of, that the record company took notice of. It was the beginning of a real relationship going. So all of a sudden you're being observed and watched a lot more closely than you had been previously. All of a sudden your actions have implications. It was a very, very different moment in my work life. And I thought differently about everything. I began to think about who I was, where I came from. It was a disorienting moment, but it's also one of those moments when you either find yourself on your feet or you get blown over by sort of what's happened to you and you get lost and maybe you don't find your way back. And that happens to a lot of people.
I've been working real hard trying to get my hands clean. We'll drive that dusty road from underway.
Stuart McConey.
I quite like Dancing Ninja 10 in general because it's a very underrated record, because he has this habit of following up a huge record with quite a muted record. So quite a strange record, quite somber.
Things that Bruce wrote about, not least on Badlands and Prove It All Night, took a fundamental turn as well. Up to now, his best songs had been about escape, about running away from a repressive community. But once the lovers from Born to Run stopped sprinting, where did they end up?
Those were the questions that sort of came up for me at that particular time. Was initially you're in search of a certain sort of freedom, you know, you want some sense of control of the arc that your life is going to take. You know, grew up in a particular environment where those things were very circumscribed, you know. You had a very particular sort of place you were going to fit into, and so your initial thrust is to explode those limits for yourself.
I got a 69 Chevy with a 396 Fuley heads and a Hurst on the floor. She's waiting tonight down in the parking outside the 7-Eleven store. Me and my partner, Sonny, built her straight out of scratch, and he rides with me from town to town. We only run for the money, got no strings attached. We shut him up and then we shut him down. Tonight the strip's just right. I wanna blow 'em off in my first heat. Summer's here and the time is right for racing in the street.
Billy Bragg.
Well, I think when he stopped shouting and started getting serious about things, there's an incredible moment in Darkness on the Edge of Town, when it comes to track 5, where he's kind of like, before that, he's kind of still kind of like, you know, shouty Bruce Springsteen doing big things. And all of a sudden, you come to Racing in the Street. And here's a song ostensibly about cars and girls, but the whole way he's singing it, it's almost as if he's taking one of his huge, great big songs that everyone's familiar with, and he's doing it as a contrast to its usual arrangement, as he often does. But with Racing in the Street, it actually is a really, really sad, inward-looking song, and I think that's the first real moment that it struck me that there's something more going on here than just Born to Run, which is a great song, and I admired his songwriting before then. But I think the thing for me about Racing in the Street is that it's the first song where you really start to get a message from Bruce that he understands that there's something deeply sad underneath the American dream, that it's actually quite hollow. He kind of builds on that subsequently, particularly on the river, you know, the famous punchline is a dream of life, it doesn't come true.
Little Steven.
I mean, we didn't know how to make records for quite a while. It took quite a while before that caught up. Didn't really equal out to The River, which was the fifth album. The record started to feel like what would happen live.
Everybody's got a hungry heart.
Springsteen's answer to the dilemma of success was to produce his most ambitious record to date. In 1980, he released the double album The River, an album full of hits, but also of dark and brooding meditations on family relationships.
Well, Papa, go to bed now. It's getting late. Nothing we can say is gonna change anything now. I'll be leaving in the morning from St. Mary's Gate. We wouldn't change this thing even if we could somehow. Cause the darkness of this house has got the best of us. There's a darkness in this town that's got us too. But they can't touch me now, and you can't touch me now. They ain't gonna do to me what I watched them do to you. So say goodbye, it's Independence Day. It's Independence Day all down the line.
Just Independence Day. The River was, Bruce remembers, a key moment.
By the time we got into the river, I felt adulthood was on the horizon, if it had not yet arrived, you know? And so I knew that I was going to be following my characters over a long period of time. And I thought it would be fun. It was what I was interested in doing, and I thought it would be interesting and fun for my audience to have a certain sort of continuity. Not real explicit or overly literal or confined, but just a loose continuity from record to record that allowed people to know who you were and where you were going and what you were trying to do.
I come from down in the valley where Mr. when you're young, they bring you up to do like your daddy done. Me and Mary, we met in high school and she was just 17. We'd drive out of this valley down to where we go down to the river, and into the river we dive. Oh, down to the river we ride.
But The River might have been a very different record if Bruce had followed his instincts more exactly. A growing interest in and engagement with politics in its broadest sense had begun to surface in his life and his music. It began with an appearance at the No Nukes concert of the same year and the recording of Roulette, a song written about the Three Mile Island nuclear accident.
It was the first song we cut for that record, and maybe I thought it was too specific later on, that it wasn't general enough, and in the end, the story I'd started to move to tell was a little more of a general one on the river. It went a little over the top, which is what's good about it. It got left off. In truth, it should have probably gotten put on. You know, it would have been one of the best things on the record, and it was just a mistake at the time. You get very oversensitive when you're going to release the thing.
Left the toys out in the yard. I took my wife and kids and I left my home unguarded. In fact, we could into the car.
The River kept Bruce's career on an upward path and brought him back to Europe.
I'd gotten my nerve up and went back.
But this time, the experience was a very different one.
At that particular point, America was really, it was the early 80s, and the sense of violence was in the air on a daily basis. Sometimes I was 30, having kids was on the horizon in some fashion. And just sort of the way things were put to you, you know, either whether it was through television or through different, it was just much more aggressive and abusive. truly abusive. I experienced less of that in Europe, just less of it. The other thing was we really connected with the European audience at that time.
Little Stephen.
I started to feel that this rock and roll thing was remarkable. When you hear people in a different country singing your lyrics back to you, even though they don't speak the language, I felt this is really some sort of universal communication that we don't use often enough.
Well, I rode that ribbon highway. I saw above me the endless skyway. I saw below me the golden valley. Well, this land was made for you and me. Well, this land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest, to the Gulf Stream waters. Well, this land was made for you and me. Now the sun came shining.
Starting a pattern that would sustain him for much of his later career, Springsteen's response to the worldwide success of The River was to take a step back from the circus and change direction. Not even he was ready for what came next, though, a literal solo album, recorded on cassette and containing some of the most powerful songs of his career.
Well, the entire record of Nebraska, I had no intention of really recording in that fashion whatsoever. It was a mistake, you know. It was an accident, let's say, you know.
Bill Flanagan.
I think Nebraska was an incredibly important record for Springsteen, and I think you could make a case that it was even his best record.
There's a place out on the edge of town, sir, rising above the factories and the fields. Ever since I was a child, I can remember that mansion on the hill. And the day you can't see the children playing on the road that leads those gates of hardened steel. Steel gates that completely surround the mansion on the hill.
I think I'd read it in a review someplace that someone mentioned the record had a variety of political implications, and at the time, that was my most personal record. It was a record that felt most like my childhood, you know. It was a record that reminded me of the way my childhood felt. Just in the tone of it, the colors that it had on it, just the house that I grew up in. And so for me, I think I was sort of digging into that in a certain way. I don't know how those stories particularly evolved. They were things I'd gotten interested in.
There was nothing more unexpected in 1982, sort of the height of New Wave, and at the time of the greatest disrepute of folkies. Springsteen came out with an acoustic album made on a cassette in his bedroom.
Nebraska is a favorite album of many musicians and fans, not least Jesse Malin.
Johnny's waving
I was into punk rock. My dad gave me Nebraska, which was done on a four-track. It's just him and an acoustic guitar. And I was like, man, this guy's a millionaire, a billionaire, and he seems real. There's just something really true about this record, and stark and honest and really dark. And so it got me thinking really different. I started reading the lyrics, and I went back and realized that everything I thought he was glorifying, you know, even with Born USA and all that, that it was really about getting out of that. It was the opposite. It was about getting out of New Jersey or this small mainstream kind of town.
I think it was an incredibly important step. It was very well received, first of all. People loved it, which was in itself kind of a triumph. For a record like that, it sold shockingly well, which showed that his audience was willing to make turns with him and follow him into unexpected places.
The stark landscapes of the Nebraska album, you can almost hear the wind blowing all the way from Nebraska down to the Texas Panhandle through that album.
I think that it often happens that a band gets to a certain commercial point and a certain musical point where you can tell that the next step can make them into household names, can bring it to everybody, can conquer top 40 radio. And the very brave and ambitious artists don't immediately take that next step. They do something to sort of solidify the relationship with the audience. So everyone was waiting now for what Born in the USA became, for the big record that was going to sell zillions and give him a string of hit singles. And Springsteen chose that moment to kind of pause, pull back, and say to his audience, let's make sure we really know each other before we go on that trip, and let's make sure that you're in this for as much as I am. And it takes a lot of courage.
I'd reached a point where I was old enough now to realize what was missing. And so I felt like I was teetering on this sort of void very often. And I felt a deep, deep sense of isolation and very difficult to get in. And it became very, very intense around that time. And I think that led me to those characters and to those kinds of stories. I just felt like that, you know, for my own reasons, you know. When you get older, the price for not sorting through the issues that make up your emotional life and the choices you're making doesn't stay the same. It gets higher all the time. And at that point, I felt like I was at a place where I could start to really feel that price, you know. At the same time I recorded Nebraska, I was recording Born in the USA in the studio in New York, so I had these two extremely different recording experiences going. I was in my house with a little tape player about, you know, three or four times the size of this book with a couple of microphones and these songs that I'd written that I wasn't sure where they came from. And then I was going to the city and cutting this big sort of studio album, you know. They happened simultaneously. There was a period where I was going to put them out as a double record. They were both going to come out at the same time. I didn't know what to do with it. Born down in a dead man's town. The first kick that took us when I hit the ground. End up like a dog that's been beat too much. Till you spend half your life just to cover it up now. Born in the USA. I was born in the USA. I was born in the USA. Born in the USA. Now, got in a little hometown jam. So they pulled a rifle in my hands. Sent me off to a foreign land. To go and kill the yellow man. Born in the USA. Born in the USA. Born in the USA. Born in the USA. Come back home to
the... It was just our time. You know, it was like the Born in the USA thing coinciding with the whole American thing and Reagan thing and, I don't know, misinterpretations or whatever came into play at that point, and it just all sort of worked, you know, intentionally or unintentionally. Remarkable success, way beyond what you would even dream of.
Next time, we'll look at how Bruce Springsteen used his conflicting creative impulses to surprise and wrongfoot both fans and critics to enter the most successful phase of his career to date. An American Life, the Bruce Springsteen story, was produced for BBC Radio 2 by Unique, the production company.
This is Hubert Gregg, seated once again in the Friday night square chair.
This is Johnny Walker, and you're listening to An American Life, the Bruce Springsteen story. Bruce Springsteen's career had been on a constant upward trajectory, not just commercially, but musically. Despite the darker side of life that he always acknowledged, there was a celebration of life, even in the bleaker moments on Darkness at the Edge of Town and The Succeeding River. 1982's starkly recorded Nebraska was an abrupt turn into more desolate terrain. But 2 years later, Bruce would surprise the critics again.
I get up in the evening, and I ain't got nothing to say. I come home in the morning, I go to bed feeling the same way. I ain't nothing but tired. Man, I'm just tired and bored with myself. Hey there, baby, I could use just a little bit. You can't start a fire.
I would have regretted terribly if I felt like I had that opportunity and hadn't made the most of it or hadn't taken it to where I thought I could, you know? It's not something I would particularly want to relive in the way that I did at that time.
After the low-key desperation of Nebraska, the last thing the world was expecting in the summer of 84 was a pop-friendly Bruce Springsteen, but that's just what they got. Complete with a Brian De Palma-directed video featuring a then-unknown Courtney Cox, Dancing in the Dark made Bruce a mass-market commodity. Not bad when you consider what the song was actually about.
Dancing in the Dark, John Landau was pressing me to write a hit record. And it was the end of Born in the USA. We had a big argument in the hotel room one night, and he said, well, you know, how's the record finished? He said, oh, no, it's not finished, you know. We need a hit, you know. So I got angry at him, and I forget we had a blowout. And then later that night, I said, okay, well, I don't have anything left to write about. You know, if you want to hit, you write it, you know. I said, okay, well, I don't have anything to write about. And that's what I'll write about.
You're sitting around getting older. There's a joke, yes, while, and it's on me. I shake this world off my shoulders. Come on, baby, the laugh's on me. Stay on your streets for this time, and they'll be carving you up all right. You say you gotta stay hungry. Hey, baby, I'm just a fast start in the night. I'm dying for some action. I'm sick of sitting around here trying to write this book.
But at that time, I was 33, already been playing for 20 years. And I was interested in what could I do. I mean, I didn't have any idea that that particular record would end up being as popular as it was. But I knew when we cut that song that it was going to capture people's imagination, probably in a way that possibly I hadn't since I wrote Born to Run.
Early Bruce Springsteen fan, now with the MTV networks, Bill Flanagan believes Springsteen's move into the mainstream was a conscious decision.
For a long time, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band were kind of the biggest cult band in the world. They had a huge following, but they weren't really in the mainstream. And I think that the choices they made on Born in the USA, the songs, the keyboard sound, the snap of the drums, the precision of it, the hooks of it, were them consciously stepping into the mainstream and saying, you know, if you're gonna do this, then why not do it for everybody? That's the idea of the Beatles. That's the idea of Elvis Presley. That's the idea of Motown. reach everybody you can. And if you can do that without taking an artistic detour, without compromising yourself, then you're kind of chicken if you don't. And, you know, really, in rock and roll, it's supposed to be about getting on the radio. It's supposed to be about challenging and changing the mainstream. It's about reaching everybody, not just the people who read music magazines.
Hey, little girl, is your daddy home? Did he go and leave you all alone? I got a bad desire. Oh, I'm on fire. Tell me now, baby, is it good to you? And can he do to you the things that I do? I can take you higher. Ooh, I'm on fire.
If you try to reach everybody, of course then everybody can reach you. And you might just start believing your own press. That's the classic rock and roll trap. And it's one that Springsteen was determined to avoid.
No matter how wonderful or intricate or complex your creation is, you know, it has the limits of being a creation. And I think that in the end, really to find yourself and to find the things you need, you've got to go outside of that place, you know. I think the people who have attempted to live within that particular world they've created have suffered tremendously for it and pay really a terrible price for it. And the older you get, the higher that price is.
Here comes a fireman. Here comes a cop. Here comes a wrench, here comes a car hop. Been going on forever, it ain't ever gonna stop. Everybody wants to be the man at the top. Everybody wants to be the man at the top. Everybody wants to be the man at the top now. Aim your gun, son, and shoot your shot. Everybody wants to be the man at the top. Rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief, doctor, lord, and MC. One thing in common they all got. Everybody wants to be the man at the top. Everybody wants to be the man at the top. Everybody wants to be the man at the top now. Aim your gun, son, and shoot your shot. Everybody wants to be the man at the top.
The new bigger scale and increased audience was something that Springsteen himself unashamedly enjoyed.
I like to make my records, I like to go out and find the audience that's out there for them. It was at the right time for me. It was before I had my kids, and I'd had a lot of experience, and I was prepared for the things that happened.
The E Street Band is a great, great rock group. What you have there is a unit that kind of represents what the songs are about. It seems as if the characters, the sense of friendship, the sense of relationships enduring through time and through enormous changes is very much of a piece with Springsteen's songs.
I had a plan, was a big band.
Stephen.
Maybe it's a Jersey, New York thing. I don't know. The nickname thing was already there. You know, we didn't form a band and say, let's have a bunch of nicknames and make that our thing. You know, that wasn't really, it wasn't that kind of consciousness whatsoever going on. I mean, it just was just, it all just sort of was our pretty much natural, organic thing. One of many New Jersey cultural traits or whatever that would end up being universal, which Bruce would deal with quite often. And interestingly enough, 20 years later, same thing would happen to The Sopranos. Yeah.
uniquely New Jersey.
Guitarist and right-hand man Little Steven played on the album, born in the USA, but left to follow a solo career before the tour, watching the Springsteen phenomenon from a distance.
Looking back, it's a strange record to have seven top 10 hit singles on. If you listen to the songs, they don't fit in. You listen to them now, I mean, there were hits like Working on the Highway, you know, these crazy songs. Now we're in an era where there's no such thing as a rock and roll hit single. But we had seven, which equaled Michael Jackson at the time, which is just absurd, of course, which is how you get to 20 million records, of course. But it was just our time. It just all sort of worked, you know, intentionally or unintentionally. The remarkable success went way beyond what you would even dream of. You know.
A lot of the things that happened to Springsteen were as a result of this song. The title track of his 1984 album, in its release version, Born in the USA, was a scathing attack on modern-day America, as seen through the eyes of a Vietnam veteran. Many casual listeners, and some presidents, just saw the Stars and Stripes and heard the song as a jingoistic anthem, a long way from its source as a country blues moan.
Born down a dead man's town. The first kick I took was when I hit the ground. Like a dog, this must be too much. You spend half your life just to color in a Born in the USA. Born in the USA. Born in the USA. Born in the USA. I got in a little hometown jam. And so they put a
Billy Bragg.
There's a lesson to be learned from Bruce's experience, because he clearly thought that he was using these images in a way to counter the Reaganite agenda, but obviously he put so much into it that it really struck a chord with those guys.
Stuart McConey.
Born in the USA, which was wrongly taken up by a lot of people as being simply a gung-ho expression of American values, and in fact it's a very critical and affectionate critique of American society from the point of view of an ordinary guy who hasn't actually been very kind to him.
Badly Drawn Boys, Damon Goff.
It is about people that he knew growing up in an era where they were sent off to Vietnam to fight for the country, supposedly, and all that went wrong, and it was a futile war, and it's happened again since, and that's what the song's about, but the people just hear the chorus, and Bruce has talked about this over the years, endlessly, and I even had a conversation when I was in Australia, touring myself recently, looking forward to seeing Bruce on the tour, and people said the ticket sales were being affected by the war and the perception of America again, and Bruce being a representative of what America is, and I found that astonishing.
Bill Flanagan reckons the wider American public got the message.
I think people got it. I think people understood that there was a mixture of pride and disappointment, defiance, anger in that song. I mean, it wasn't completely ironic. It was a guy who had loved his country and had really found himself at the end of his rope and didn't know what he had done wrong and was sort of clinging to the promise and the curse of the chant, Born in the USA. The notion that the album became popular because a lot of dumb Reaganites assumed that it was Morning in America, I think is condescending and probably wrong. I think people understood the song. And, you know, and some people didn't, but then some people don't care. You know, some people just hear a song on the radio and they remember the chorus and they kind of like it. And it has to work on that level, too. That doesn't mean that those people are wrong either. I'm sure that I've totally missed the subtleties of Hit Me Baby One More Time by Britney Spears, because really that's all I hear.
It was a record that I truly wouldn't have made in any other fashion. I think when any work goes out there, and is open to different types of interpretation, and that's part of the role of the dice. I think that you write to be understood, but at the same time, it was a record that I felt that I probably could have made a record that would have been more easily understood, but it might not have been as good. I felt like it was a second take. I just felt like we caught it. I mean, I feel like the record is right on the money. There may be some misinterpretations of it out there, you know, but it was the right record.
The runway rushed up at him as he felt the wheels touch down.
In truth, Born in the USA was the culmination of a theme in Springsteen's writing that had first surfaced before The River. The experiences of the Vietnam veterans, such as on Shut Out the Light.
And went into a local bar. He bought a drink and found a seat in a corner in the dark. Well, she called up her mama to make sure the kids were out of the house. She checked herself out in the dining room mirror and undid an extra button on her blouse. He felt her lying next to him when the clock said 4 a.m. He was staring at the ceiling, he couldn't move his hands. Mama, 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 come go away. I got the shakes and I'm gonna be sick. Throw your arms around me in the cold dark night. Hey now, mama, don't shut out the light. Don't you 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 shut out the light. Well, on his porch he stretched a banner.
It began when I met Ron Kovic in a sort of a strange experience where I was driving across the country and I stopped in Arizona in a drugstore and I bought a book called Born on the 4th of July and I drove on to Los Angeles. And a week or so later, I was in this little motel and I was sitting at the pool and a fella come up to me and started to talk to me and he introduced himself. And I said, Jeff, I must have met this fella for his name sounds real familiar, you know. And he says, yeah, I said, I wrote a book called Born on the 4th of July. And I said, wow, I said, this is a real coincidence. I just read the book a couple of weeks ago. And through Ron, he took me down into Venice to the vet center and met a fellow named Shad Meshad. And then I met Bobby Muller, who was the president of the VVA at the time. And we ended up doing a benefit for the VVA. It was just sort of getting itself together in the early 80s. And it just, one thing led to another, and it just began to surface in some of my music, you know.
Saigon, it was all gone. Same coke chains as the streets I grew on. Down a Mesquite Canyon, come walking along the ridge. Me and the brothers on the bridge. Campsites, hours walking when there's a road to town. I bet there's too much brush and canyon for the CHP choppers to touch down.
ain't looking for nothing, just wanna live. Me and the brothers under the bridge.
Brothers Under the Bridge and Shut Out the Light showed what a big impact Vietnam had on the young Bruce.
You know, I did the draft Dodger rag there at the time, you know. I was 19, and my drummer had gone and died. The best I remember this fellow, Walter Shoshone, was the best front man in central New Jersey at the time. And he joined the Marines, and he was MIA. And on the street at the time, hey, people were frightened, and everybody was trying to figure out how to get out, you know.
Me and the brothers under the bridge.
It was such a part of growing up at that time. You know, it was in your home every single night. It just became a big part of your life experience, I think. And I think that what led me to write about it was it seemed like whether you were there or whether you were at home in the United States, it was a defining moment in American culture in some fashion. You know, you felt things really change. There was before and there was after, and the world and the United States felt like a different place.
Me and the brothers under the bridge.
This is Johnny Walker, and you're listening to An American Life, the Bruce Springsteen story on BBC Radio 2.
We had many points where I think we thought it was the end.
Danny Federici.
This is as far as we're going to go. And then we had Born in USA. But up until Born in USA, I think we just thought that was probably the extent of it. You know, we make okay living and get by and have fun, and we never thought it would get to this level.
By the end of 1985, Springsteen was the biggest rock star in the world. Born in the USA had yielded an astonishing 7 smash hit singles, and a global tour resulted in some of the most powerful performances of his career, as Billy Bragg well remembers.
I think that seeing Springsteen live is crucial to understanding why he's so great. I was very fortunate in the first time I ever saw him was in some huge basketball arena in New Jersey on the Born in the USA tour on about the fifth night. I was, frankly, sceptical about Bruce, but went along at the insistence of my American agent and was just blown away because he made this huge stadium seem like a little club, and he just played and played and played, and there was no pretense to it at all. It was just, to me, it was just real honest musicianship. I like to think of myself as being sort of Ronsill man. I do what I say on the tin. You know, there's no pretense in what I do. And Springsteen's like that as well. That's who he is. He's that geezer. Jumps on the piano occasionally. But he's just as able to be incredibly tender about an issue. And to hold the attention of an arena focused on one man singing one line. To be part of that audience that feels that is an incredible feeling. But to be the bloke who's doing it, that takes some real bottle. And I have to admire him for doing it.
Damon Goff.
Credit to him, really, for still giving it the guts that he does and still playing 3-hour-plus shows. And it's like, no one gives that commitment. And that's what I've tried to do. I get the same criticism, but I'm always trying to do that, mainly because Bruce Springsteen taught me that. No one else did. I've never seen anyone else give anything that much commitment. So that's what he taught me more than anything, really, to put your soul into it.
Those epic concerts also became the focus of Springsteen's determination not to lose touch with his audiences, to forge a bond with them. In the States, there were nightly appeals for food banks and other local charities. And when the tour arrived in the UK, Bruce made headlines and had his actions raised in Parliament when he met with and donated to the wives of striking miners in northeast England. On stage, his message was equally clear.
For all the young people out there. If you're in your teens. Because I remember a lot of my friends when we were 17 or 18, we didn't have much of a chance to think about how we felt about a lot of things. And the next time they're going to be looking at you, and you're going to need a lot of information to know what you're going to want to do. Because in 1985, blind faith in your leaders or in anything will get you killed. Because what I'm talking about here is
for Bill Flanagan, it all underlined Bruce's passion and sincerity.
I think that all through his career, Springsteen has represented a certain constituency. Now, you know, I mean, I'd say it's mostly an emotional constituency, but certainly a lot of the details of his songs reflected kind of blue-collar America, working-class America, which is where an awful lot of people come from. And I think that, like many people, as he found himself standing on a bigger stage, speaking to millions of people, he had to think about what he wanted to say. Now, there's a lot of rock stars who find that moment incredibly confusing and feel that it's their job now to learn all about protecting the whale or the ecology of the sub-Saharan desert or, you know, and all these worthy things, and they can come off sounding silly even when what they're doing is very important. So I think that he was very responsible, and also I think he was very, very concerned with pointing people back toward their own communities, that although he was only in town for that one night, they were going to have to live in that town. So rather than pull people into sort of global or international issues, he simply said, here's a good group in your community. You could get involved. You could help them out.
I was 8 years old and running with a dime in my hand to the bus stop to pick up a paper from my old man. Sit on his lap, that big old Buick steer as we drove through town. Tassel my hair, say some take good look around. This is your hometown. This is your hometown. This is your hometown. This is your my school. There's a lot of fights between the black and white. There was nothing you could do. Two cars in a line on a Saturday night. In the backseat there was a gun. Words are past, shotgun blast, troubled times have come.
My Hometown, which emphasized the sense of Bruce as a grounded person who hadn't lost touch with his roots. Jesse Mallon believes Bruce has real importance to American music.
I think American music is about storytelling, and it's about, really, I think, the American dream, a lot of folklore, the working man, I think, and woman. He really is the backbone of that, of the American dream and a lot of the promises that were given, but maybe gone south. And trying to find a way to refine yourself in that, not getting, you know, falling into think if you're going to buy two cars and a nice house that you're going to be all happy, that there's other things that happen, and surviving that American dream as a potential nightmare.
In the day we sweated out on the streets of a runaway American dream, at night we ride through mansions of glory and suicide machines sprung from cages on Highway 9, chrome wheel fuel injected iron, stepping out over the line. Baby, this town rips the bones from your back. It's a death trap. It's a suicide rap. I wanna get out while I'm still young. 'Cause tramps like us, baby, we were born to run.
Thea Gilmore sees a connection between the likes of Dylan and Springsteen in the American music tradition, but sees big differences also.
It's interesting that a kind of mainstream rocker like Bruce embraces his folk past as well, you know, embraces a folk history anyway, which obviously always appeals to my sort of folky nature. And a lot of sort of rockers kind of shy away from their history, their musical history, and I really like the fact that Bruce embraces it.
For Billy Bragg, Bruce's version of Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land is another clear indicator to understanding Bruce Springsteen.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island.
We are in a tradition, kind of like singer-songwriters that are trying to address issues. You could say political singer-song, it's not really right. Topical song might be better. And surely we are all in a chain. I'm in part of that chain. The Clash are definitely in that chain. Dylan's in the chain. You know, in fact, many of us came into it via Dylan. But really, the metal spike that puts that chain into the ground is Woody Guthrie.
This land was made for you and me.
Springsteen, you know from his songwriting, you don't need the ghost of Tom Joad to know that Springsteen is part of that tradition, a really important link in that chain, that Woody Guthrie is the father of our tradition, and the rest of us, we're all kind of Woody's children, and Springsteen, I'm sure, wouldn't mind me saying that he's one of the more prominent amongst us.
This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling.
I think it was explicit before Tom Joad came out, because if you're listening to Woody Guthrie's songs, he too deals with the ambiguities in the American dream. He wrote This Land Is Your Land as an alternative to God Bless America by Irving Berlin, which was a big jukebox hit in 1940. And that ability to speak with a voice outside of the mainstream, a voice that is resonant with ordinary people, Woody Guthrie, that's what he did. That's who he was. The very first to do that, I'd argue. And Springsteen clearly is in part of that tradition and has touched on that tradition in his own work.
There's something about the way that I write and process the information that has something to do with country music, and since my late 20s it's been an enormous source of inspiration.
My name is Joe Roberts. I work for the state. I'm a sergeant out of Burnville, barracks number 8. I always done an honest job, as honest as I could. I got a brother named Frankie, and Frankie ain't no good.
Hank Williams, who just created a world. He created an entire world that was one you had never been presented with before, but that you recognized as your world, a world some part of you lived in. You know, whether I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, you know, or Hey Good Looking, those records transcend time and place. He did that, Woody Guthrie did it, obviously, you know, Bob Dylan. They were all models for me as far as the way that I approach my work.
But when it's your brother, sometimes you look the other way. Yeah, me and Frankie laughing and drinking. Nothing feels better than blood on blood. Taking turns dancing with Maria as a band played Night of the Johnstown Flood. I catch him when he streams like any brother would. Man turns his back on his family, well, he just ain't no good.
Stuart McConey.
Unlike Bob Dylan, who is rooted in American music, but he's essentially Bob Dylan all the time, Springsteen seems much more steeped in it, steeped in every corner of it, be it even like Hispanic music, even or music like that, but also the doo-wop that you heard in New Jersey and rock and roll and soul music and all that kind of thing, and street corner soul and R&B. His musical language is informed by all the different threads of American music.
The tradition Springsteen speaks of carried on outside of Bruce's own work. He lent his stage to Bob Geldof for the Live Aid concert at Wembley, sang on We Are the World, the American companion record to Do They Know It's Christmas, and on former E Streeter Little Stevens anti-apartheid song Sun City.
After that, there was a 5-album live box set, the biggest selling of all time. And then another global jaunt in support of Amnesty International, in the company of Yusun Dor, Tracy Chapman, Sting, and Peter Gabriel.
We're far between sundown's finish and midnight's broken toll. We ducked inside the door with thunder crashing. As majestic bells of bolts struck shadows in the sound, seeming to be the chimes of freedom crashing. Yeah, flashing for the warriors whose strength is not to fight. Flashing for the refugees on their unarmed road of flight. And for each and every underdog soldier in the night, we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
Right in the middle of this hectic phase, Springsteen found time to meet and marry his first wife, the actress and model Julianne Phillips. So it was no surprise that Bruce's next album was a very domestic affair, from its recording at his home studio right down to its primary subject matter. The emotional force of Tunnel of Love seemed to be fired by the speed with which Bruce's marriage was breaking down.
Tunnel of Love was just one. Once again, those were the songs that came out at the time. It was a record I made in my garage apartment when I played most of the instruments on myself. And it was one of my, after Nebraska, it was my second homemade record, you know. It just had a different sound and a different feeling, and I still think it's one of my best written records, you know, that record.
That man sitting on a little stool takes some money from my hand while his eyes take a walk all over you. Hands me two tickets, smiles and whispers good luck. Well, cuddle up, angel, cuddle up, my little dove. And we'll ride down, baby, into this tunnel of love. Well, I feel a soft silk of your blouse and through them soft grills in our little farmhouse. And the lights go out, it's just the three of us, yeah. You, me, and all that stuff we're so scared of.
Bill Flanagan sees a long thread in Tunnel of Love, stretching from Bruce's earliest days as a recording artist.
It's dangerous to assume that what any writer does is autobiographical, but I think it's safe to assume that the environment in which he creates his work is going to affect the work. It seems as if Springsteen was running full tilt for a really long time, from the moment we first became aware of him, through Born in the USA, when he sort of achieved not only rock stardom and wealth and all that kind of stuff, but I think made himself the center of rock and roll in a way, and kind of completed the process of wrenching popular music back to where he thought it should be. So, very effective, mission accomplished. You're the new Elvis. What do you do now? And with Tunnel of Love, he began to explore the domestic. What do people do one-on-one? Tunnel of Love begins a more inward-looking Bruce Springsteen. When the character thinks about ditching the wedding ring and taking off and heading down the road, and then decides not to and closes the window and goes back to bed. That is fraught with symbolism, and Springsteen's too thoughtful a guy to throw it in there if it didn't mean something.
Now Billy was an honest man. He wanted to do what was right. He worked hard to fill their lives with happy days and loving nights. Alone on his knees in the darkness, for steadiness he'd pray. For he knew in a restless heart the seed of betrayal lay. One night Billy woke from a terrible dream, calling his wife's name. She lay breathing beside him in a peaceful sleep, a thousand miles away. He got dressed in the moonlight, and down to the highway he strode. When he got there, he didn't find nothing but road. Billy felt a coldness rise up inside him that he couldn't name. Just as the words tattooed across his knuckles, he knew it always remained. At their bedside he brushed the hair from his wife's face. The moon shone on her skin so white, filling their room in the beauty of God's falling light.
Bruce himself says there's always a personal element to his songs.
I always think you're always writing about yourself. You're not writing literally about yourself or specifically about yourself, but there's got to be some part of you in everything.
I hold you in my arms. Is a band playing? But all those words whispered, baby, just as you turn away.
Create understanding, to see yourself in them. You know, that's really what you do. I think you try to find that place where there's a fundamental human commonality around very basic issues of work, faith, hope, family, desperation, exuberation, joy. And you've got to find that place. If you don't, the song always fails, unless you can find yourself in those characters in some fashion.
I heard somebody call your name from underneath a willow. I saw something tucked in shame underneath your pillow. Well, I tried so hard, baby, but I just can't see. Oh, what a woman like you is doing with me. So tell me who I see. Is that
darkness of our love. God have mercy on the man who doubts what he so loves.
I thought I hadn't really written about men and women until Tunnel of Love, but I went back and I found Stolen Car, you know, basically. If you don't connect yourself to your family and to the world in some fashion, through your job or whatever it is you do, you feel like you're disappearing. You feel like you're fading away, you know. And I think growing up, I felt like that a lot. That I was just invisible, you know. I was just an invisible person.
I met a little girl and I settled down in a little house out on the edge of town. We got married and swore we'd never part. Then little by little we drifted from each other's heart. First I thought was just restlessness that would fade as time went by. And our love grew deep. In the end, it was something more, I guess. It tore us apart and made us weep. Driving a stolen car down on Eldridge Avenue. Each night I wait to get caught, but I never do. She asked if I remember the letters I wrote when I
struggle to make yourself felt and visible, to have some impact and to create meaning for yourself and for the people you come in touch with was central to all my work. And then with Stolen Car, the idea that that includes being able to have an intimate life that is essential to filling out your life. He was the first guy that started to wrestle with that idea, you know. He was the first guy.
This is Jesse Mallon.
He's a great storyteller. I think his songs are real and they're very cinematic. They're very slice of life. There's a lot of romance in it, in the darkness and in these characters that are struggling for surviving. There's a lot of hope, you know. There's something really human. It's like a celebration of life.
Well, it's Saturday night. You're all dressed up.
It's not like naive, like let's disco, baby. It's like, you know, we're here. It's very working class. So it really connected to my Clash, Dead Kennedys, crass, working class punk rock aesthetic in a certain way. And similar like to punk, it gets misunderstood.
Left somebody's heart in a mess. Well, if you're looking for love, honey, I'm tougher than the rest. Some girl, they want a handsome dame or some good-looking Joe.
had to find some way to integrate yourself into some part of the community that you come from, and that gave center, focus, force, power, immediacy, vitalness to what you were going to write about and the work you were going to do.
So if you're revving up for love, honey, I'm tougher than the rest.
Isolation is a big part of American character, you know, and I think it's just, hey, you know, you always had the guys that were just, they got a little crowded and they went further on, you know, whether it's to leave behind what you've created, you know, which everyone wants to do at some point. You want to, everybody wakes up on those mornings when you just feel like you want to walk away and start brand new.
Men walking along the railroad tracks, going someplace and there's no going back. Highway patrol choppers coming up over the ridge. Hot soup on a campfire under the bridge. Shelter line stretching around the corner. Welcome to the new world order. Family sleeping in the car in the southwest. No home, no job, no peace, no rest. Highway is alive tonight. Nobody's kidding nobody about where it.
Next time, we'll see how Tunnel of Love appropriately led into the most low-key and misunderstood phase of Bruce's career, but how it eventually led to another dark but magnificent artistic triumph.
Pulls a prayer book out of his sleeping bag. Preacher lights up a butt and takes a drag. Waiting for when the last shall be first and the first shall be last. In a cardboard box near the underpass. Got a one-way ticket to the promised land. You got a hole in your belly and a gun in your hand. Sleeping on a pillow of solid rock. Bathing in the city.
Bruce Springsteen and American Life was produced for BBC Radio 2 by Unique, the production company.
BBC Radio 2.
This is Johnny Walker, and you're listening to An American Life, the Bruce Springsteen story.
By the autumn of 1989, Bruce Springsteen was a man in transition. His first marriage had failed, and his 40th birthday just passed. Springsteen had a huge worldwide audience waiting on his next move. True to form, it wasn't the obvious one.
I didn't have a great time during the Tunnel of Love tour, I'll admit that. I was about to quit the band, and we were doing the Tunnel of Love material, which I hadn't played on the record. It wasn't with the E Street Band, and it was a very set performance, and everything was kind of like choreographed, and I got bored, and I didn't want to do it anymore. And then about halfway through the tour, we played East Germany, and all that just wasn't going over. And all of a sudden, Bruce turned around and called out Badlands and some things we hadn't played, you know, on the whole tour for months. And we broke into it, and it was great. And from that time forward, I'd enjoyed the rest of the tour because it changed the whole mold. But when we started out that tour, I didn't feel like it was the E Street Band, and didn't really feel part of it.
Spread out my walls, Dr. Clark cutting some mama's hands.
After working with the musicians who make up the E Street Band, in some cases for nearly two decades, Springsteen decided it was time for a change. He broke the news in a series of calls, to the surprise of some, but not to once and future bandmate Stephen Van Zandt.
I was not surprised. I looked at Van and go, I think it was time to try some new things. And he did, leading to some very interesting and very high quality work, you know. You need that sometimes. You need a change of environment, a change of people you're playing with, whatever it is, you know. Nothing wrong with that.
I bought a bourgeois house in the Hollywood Hills with a trunk load of $100,000 bills. Man came by to hook up my cable TV. We settled in for the night, my baby and me. We switched round and round till half past dawn. There was 57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing on.
Springsteen felt a change at this point was necessary.
Well now, home entertainment was my baby's wish, so
I'd run out of ideas, you know, to do with the band, and you know, we've been together a long time. There's probably little things that grate on you about this guy, and some little, you grate on them in some fashion. Just normal human tiredness, you know, probably. And the fact that I didn't have any ideas of where to go with it. The fidelity we'd had was a deep emotional bond, but it also was like, hey, what's going on in the rest of the world? I don't know. You know, what do other musicians sound like and play like, and what's that about? You know, so I had some curiosity about that. And it was just, once we put out the live record after Born in the USA, it just felt like, well, this is the time to take a break and see where it leads, you know, see where it goes. And it was good. You know, people changed and grew up and I think came back with a renewed appreciation of the band. I certainly have one, and I think that a lot of the guys would say the same. You know, when you're young, you don't always appreciate what you have there in front of you and its importance. And, you know, you always give a little less credit to the next guy than he probably deserves, and vice versa, you know. So those are things that, you know, it was very good. You know, people went out and found their own lives, and, you know, Gary produced and Max did the film TV, and Clarence has his own band that he plays with, and Steve does the acting on The Sopranos. So it was a place people went out and had a chance to find all those other things outside the band, which I think when we came back together are things that strengthened the band, and it's an incredibly free space right now, you know. It's just a very open and creative and nice place to be, you know.
Gary Talent.
I was kind of excited for him, thinking that at that time Paul Simon had just done Graceland and to really work with some different musicians, world musicians, and just bring his thing somewhere different. And he had that opportunity. I thought it was great for him. And then I was disappointed that what he did was kind of like had other people trying to sound like an E Street Band. That's kind of how it worked out anyway. I thought it was a great moment, a great opportunity for him. But in a way, I'm kind of glad it didn't work out, because I'm having a good time.
Little Stephen.
If you go back and could rewrite the book, you know, I mean, I think I would have rather we all stayed together and done our other things on the side. And I would always recommend that to any band. If you have a band, you must keep it together. Find a way to keep it together. And then do whatever else you want to do in between band records, you know? So, I mean, I wish we had done that. But, you know, things go the way they go. And in the end, it's okay. Everything worked out fine, you know?
I'll wake up tomorrow in another state. Kiss me now, baby, before it's too late.
The next step in this reinvention was more of a geographical one. Perhaps more than any other artist in rock history, Springsteen's life had become synonymous with his work. So much so that bands like Prefab Sprout could poke fun at him with ease.
Look at a Sprout, I'm driving. Some things hurt more, much more than cars and girls. Just look at a Sprout.
In the minds of his audience, Bruce was New Jersey. A connection that he, of course, had encouraged at the beginning of his career with songs like Sandy.
Sandy, the fireworks are hailing over Little Eden tonight. Forcing a light into all those stony faces left stranded on this warm
July. Down in town, the circuit's full of switchblade lovers. So fast, so shiny, so sharp. As the wizards play down on Pinball Way, on the boardwalk way past dark. And the boys from the casino dance with their shirts open like Latin lovers on the shore, chasing all them silly New York virgins by the score.
I did was I rooted myself in a sense of place, in a particular geography. I was very specific about wanting to let people know I was from New Jersey, I wasn't from New York. And because the music felt like this town at that time, boardwalk influences and just the abstract, just the way I was writing lyrics at the time, that it had a very particular sense of place. And that's a powerful thing to be able to conjure, and it was something I was interested in from the moment I started. I'm not really sure why. I think because I was frightened of having my identity stripped away from me, as I felt could occur and did occur once you involved yourself in the pop music business, you know. And I think I was very, very frightened of that, and so I went to great lengths both in my music and in the way that I presented my music to just show the roots of where you came out of, you know, that there was a place and there was a town and there was a certain sort of street life and that this music grew from that location.
What he once saw as an advantage, Springsteen now viewed as limiting, and faced with that problem, he chose to follow in the footsteps of so many other American heroes. He moved west.
We'd been hearing too many voices and feeling a little off track, like there was something big pressing down on his back. So he called up his friends and they said, come on out west, it's a place where a man can really feel his success.
I think I'd reached a point where I wanted something different. I tried living in New York City for a while, and I just wasn't a city boy, you know. I'd had a small place in California from the early 80s on. It was a place where I could go, and I had my cars, and I had my motorcycles, and I enjoyed the geography of the state.
So he pulled his heart and soul down off the shelf, and packed them next to the faith that he'd lost in himself. Said his goodbyes, and when the dirty work was done, he turned his wheels into the fading sun.
Los Angeles is a funny town. It is set literally on the edge of the desert. You can be out of Los Angeles in 30 minutes and hit the edge of the desert and travel for 100 miles where you'll come upon two stores.
For 7 days and nights, like a blacktop bird, he sped, maintained radio silence, except for in his head, and just like his folks did back in 69, he crossed the border at Needles and heard the promised land on the line.
I loved it. I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, out on the outskirts,
through western edge of the Mojave Desert and up towards Death Valley. It's incredible country, and it's very elemental, you know, and you are dwarfed in it, and it puts your daily concerns in immediate perspective in a way that is very clearing in some fashion, you know.
Now with the transcontinental dumps into the sea, there's a bar I made up a look like 1963. Girl in the corner eyed him like a hungry dog a bone as he brushed the desert dust off that Mercedes chrome. Bartender said he has a hanging tiger. He shot a tequila, smiled and whispered lighter. He went down to the desert city where the rattlesnakes play and left his dead skin by the roadside in the noon of day. Sun got so hot it almost felt like friend it could burn out every trace of where you've been. There was a woman he'd met in a desert song, and a little while later the sun come along. He looked at that boy's smile and called it home, and that night as he lay in bed the only voice he heard was his own.
In 1992, 4 years after the release of Tunnel of Love, a new Springsteen emerged, complete with a new wife, E Street band member Patti Scialfa, and a new family.
You and me, we were the pretenders. We let it all slip away. In the end, what you don't surrender, well, the world just strips away. Girl, ain't no kindness in the.
Here's author and fan Bill Flanagan.
When he married Patti, he just seems to have found a soulmate and a wonderful, really smart person who maybe, and again, this is just an observation from someone who doesn't know them very well, but the impression I always get is that she's somebody who doesn't let him get away with anything. Patti seems kind of fiercely honest. She's one of those people who seems kind of incapable of telling a lie. Now, again, I don't know them that well, but that's the impression I get. So, you know, I think that for the first time, he was able to build a home. I don't think he ever owned a house before. And obviously, having kids is going to affect the way you look at yourself, the way you look at the world, and it's going to instill, if nothing else, some sense of permanence in your life, some sense of groundedness. About marriage, and he's written about fatherhood in his songs really brilliantly.
Well, I want a summer night. Oh, in a dusky room. Come a little piece of the Lord's undying light. Crying like you swallowed the fire. And moving down his mother's arms. So beauty I could take.
And of course, this new life came with new music. Two albums, Human Touch and Lucky Town, were released at the same time. Bruce was back, but not everyone was impressed. Here's Billy Bragg.
You can't hit the peaks that Springsteen hits all the time. If you've made such great records as The River, you're bound to sort of have periods where you're turning out Lucky Town.
Got too tight, and I don't swear I'm no
I don't know how people perceive them now. I think people perceive them as being less successful than my other records. Maybe they were, I don't know, you know. I haven't listened to them in a while myself. There's a lot of things on them that I like, and particularly Lucky Town, I felt held and fell together really well.
Yeah, it's to your girls, baby. I kissed my head, kissed to the bloody places that we take ourselves. When it comes to love, you make out like dirt on my hands, but I'm building you.
The record that really followed Tunnel of Love. Human Touch was sort of the record I made trying to get to that record in the middle, you know. And for once, instead of keeping the stuff in a can, I put it out. And there's a lot of things on that I like. I don't know if I can really judge, you know. But if you do it and you put it out, you usually you think it's good. You know, I think the time and your audience and things will give you a little more perspective on it. There are a lot of good songs on those records, you know. But I don't know exactly how my fans would perceive them at the moment. You know.
All over the world, the rain was pouring. I was scratching where it itched. Oh, heartbreak and despair got nothing but thorns. So I grabbed you, baby, like a wild bitch. It takes a leap of faith.
A rejuvenated Springsteen now resumed his career at full tilt, touring with a new band of young musicians and seeking out new artistic challenges. The most successful of these, Streets of Philadelphia, brought him a different sound, a route into a different world, and an Oscar to put on his shelf.
I got a call from Jonathan Demme one day, and he told me he was working on a picture, and he just said he was looking for a rock song. So, I have a little studio in my house, went down and came up with that beat and just sort of laid the lyrics over top of it, almost speaking it.
I was bruised and battered, I couldn't tell what I felt. I was unrecognizable to myself. I saw my reflection in a window and didn't know my own face. Oh brother, are you gonna leave me wasting away? Streets of Philadelphia.
Took a couple of hours, I think, for the main body of the song. I wrote it pretty quickly. I sent it off to him. I didn't know if he was going to use it or not, or if he wanted to use it, you know, because it wasn't what he'd asked for. And it was sort of a very, you know, very minimalist, small piece of music.
I walked the avenue till my legs felt like stone. I heard voices of friends vanished and gone. At night I could hear the blood in my veins, just as black and whispering as the rain on the streets of Philadelphia.
There was something that people were trying to make sense of at the time, you know. There's certain songs I've written where there's just those things in the air, I think, what people were trying to sort out. How to address age within their own families and within their own communities. And I think, you know, when you write, you assist people in taking those things and making some sense out of them in their own lives.
Ain't no angel gonna greet me. It's just you and I, my friend. And my clothes don't fit me no more. I walk 1,000 miles just to slip this ski. Night is falling, I'm blind awake. I can feel myself fading away. So receive me, brother, with your faithless kiss. Or will we leave each other alone like this on the streets of Philadelphia?
This is Johnny Walker, and you're listening to An American Life, the Bruce Springsteen story on BBC Radio 2. ...1995 brought an E Street Band reunion of sorts, as the band got back together for a greatest hits project. But 2 years later, Bruce's next move was to do what long-term fans had prayed for since the beginning. He went acoustic, releasing one of his most acclaimed projects, The Ghost of Tom Joad.
Men walking along the railroad tracks, going someplace and there's no going back. Highway patrol choppers coming up over each. Hot soup on a campfire in the bridge. Shelter line stretching around the corner. Welcome to the new world order. Family sleeping in the car in the southwest. No home, no job, no peace, no rest. Well, the highway is alive tonight. But nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes. I'm sitting down here in the campfire line. Searching for the ghost of Tom Joad. He pulls a prayer book out of his sleeping bag.
You're always searching for the voice to sing a particular song in. And I think you end up coming up with a mix of your own voice and then that your character's voice. And when you meld them well is when you feel at ease. You know, on the Tom Joad record, I spent a lot, not a lot of time, but I had something when I located that voice. Even before I had a full song, if I had a verse, but I knew how the person spoke, and I was able to translate that into a vocal style. Very, very plain, very presentational, but then I felt like, well, yeah, I have a sense of who this person is.
The highway is alive tonight. Where it's headed, everybody knows. I'm sitting down here. Waiting on the ghost of Tom Joad.
If you're writing something that you can't sing, it just feels false. It's either the line is probably not right, you know? So it can guide you through the completion of your music. But if you go too far, then you're imitating. Then you're just putting it on. If you find the exact right spot, you're pulling it into yourself and pulling yourself up, and those things are coming together.
Fight against the blood and hatred in the air. Look for me, Mom, I'll be there. There's somebody fighting for a place to stay. A decent job or a helping hand. Maybe somebody struggling to be free. Look in the eyes, Mom, you'll see me. Highway is alive tonight. And nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes. I'm sitting down here in the campfire line with the ghost of old Tom Joad.
Tom Joad was great music of its type, but as the new century loomed, there was an increasing feeling that Springsteen truly belonged in the rock arena. In 1999, he bowed to the inevitable and put the E Street Band back on the road.
After the Tom Joad tour and album, I thought I might do that again. I thought I might continue to
work acoustically for a while. And I did write a lot of songs on that tour, and I recorded about half a record, a little bit more of acoustic music. And when I got into it, first of all, it wasn't finished, and I couldn't quite finish it at that time. And also, it had been a while since I'd played on stage with a rock band. It's an essential part of what I did, and certainly it's a long time since I played with the E Street Band. And I felt like, gee, if I was going to do that again, it was just the right time to do it, you know, and I called the fellas, and we talked about it a little bit. And I think I just wanted to, and I needed to connect with the part of me that does that very physical stage show. And those people, you know, were central to my whole life, people you grew up with. And I was turning 50, and I said, gee, you know, I just want to see where we can take it, you know, what we can do with it. I think differently when I think about writing with the band in mind.
For returning guitarist Little Steven, the reunion was a revelation.
You can't remember what happens when you walk on a stage and you hear that audience roar. You can't quite remember what that sounds like. I really felt good about being reconnected with the audience. But I really felt that entire rock audience that we helped create through the 70s and 80s was abandoned in the 90s to a large extent. Virtually everybody seemed to disappear one way or the other. You know? A couple new things popped up, you know, the Northwest stuff, Pearl Jams and that, and Guns N' Roses, and, you know, a few hard rock things, heavy metal things popped up, but most of the other bands just seemed to go away. I mean, I don't know what exactly happened there, but, you know, we were sort of gone, and Tom Petty was gone, and Bob Seger was gone, and Mellencamp was gone, and so I was very happy to re-plug in that connection. It's very inspiring. It was remarkably effortless. I don't think we rehearsed more than 4 weeks or so. Which, you know, after 18 years, you know, you think you'd rehearse a bit more than that. It was 18 years for me and 10 years for the rest of them. It just was the old riding a bicycle cliche. Just like that. I mean, it was virtually no discussion, virtually no rehearsal. We just said, let's go.
If it hadn't been clear before, it was now obvious the E Street Band were far more than just the sum of their parts.
As Paul McCartney has said, it's very easy for the musician to underestimate how important psychologically the band is to the audience.
Bill Flanagan.
So, of course, people were very, very happy to have the E Street Band back, and would have been happy to have them back sort of under any circumstances. I'm sure people would have been delighted if all they'd done was come out and play Kitties back and sort of relive the glory days of 1975. But I think it's a great credit to Springsteen that he was determined that the band come back with new material, even if people hadn't heard it yet. And to some degree, carrying everything that had happened to them along the way. It was also just fascinating that they played differently, that Nils learned steel guitar for this, that in the current version of the band there's a fiddle player, that the songs were allowed to have grown up with the group. Springsteen also made a very interesting choice. It was hardly even commented on, just in the initial 2 year Return of the E Street Band tour, they didn't do any of their big hit singles.
Grab your ticket and your suitcase. Thunder's rolling down this track. Well, you don't know where you're
Which I think was also a way of reestablishing the fact that before they were
a big pop group for a minute in the early days of MTV. They were the biggest cult rock and roll band in the world. So to some degree, it was almost as if they were showing a parallel universe where Born in the USA hadn't happened. You back the car up to around the time of The River or something, and you say, now let's go down this somewhat more rootsy road with more overt country and gospel influences. Very, very interesting.
For long-term colleagues Gary Tallent and Danny Federici, it was the rekindling of a partnership that stretched back nearly 30 years.
The key to any rock and roll band success is being able to live with all the members in the band. I think we've always had the big picture in mind. I think we didn't let the small things get in the way. Girlfriends, little personal problems. I mean, not that we're not there for each other, but little things, you know, sometimes don't really matter to bring up when we're working. When we're out here working. I think being able to live together so closely is the key.
Everybody in the band, we play well together and everybody gets along. It's not a difficult thing, and just all the history that goes with it, it makes it kind of special. You know, we're all still healthy and all still alive and all playing well, and it's like, why not do it? You know, it's great. What can I say, you know?
Held up amazingly well, composition wise, as good as it ever was, and in some ways it seemed more relevant, oddly enough. I think he was writing back then chronologically out of time. He was writing for 20 years later in a funny kind of way, whether he knew it or not, you know?
Manzoor.
I think one of his most telling songs was American Skin, where he got a lot of controversy. The song was about the shooting of a black immigrant by policemen who mistook the fact that he was, I think, taking a wallet out for a gun. And his line is that it's not easy living in your American skin. And I think that, in a sense, is kind of one of his mottos, or you could use as one of his sort of credos throughout his career, because he is talking about the difficulties of living in one's American skin.
41 shots. 41 shots. 41 shots.
Bill Flanagan.
Springsteen had written a song about a local New York controversy, the Diallo shootings, in which New York City policemen shot to death an innocent man in the doorway of his own house because they mistook him for a burglar. And it was a real ugly incident. And Springsteen wrote a thoughtful song that didn't ever mention Diallo, I believe, but the first verse was about
a black mother dressing her kid for school and just telling him the things that, as black mothers have told me, because I've talked to friends about it, you do tell a kid when he's growing up in this environment, which is if a policeman stops you, be nice, be polite, because you can get killed just for living in your American skin.
41 shots, Lena gets her son ready for school. She says, on these streets, child rules, you've got to understand the rules. If an officer stops you, promise me you'll always be polite, and that you'll never ever run away, and promise mama you'll keep your heads inside. Well, is it a gun? Is it a knife? Is it a wallet? This is your life. It ain't no secret.
For me, it was just writing about the place that I live and what defines Americanness. You know, I think that I live in a country where a lot of people of color feel denied full citizenship. They feel denied full Americanness. And the Diallo case became a metaphor for that feeling. It was just something I wanted to write about.
He did the song once, somewhere in Virginia or Washington or something, and he was coming to Madison Square Garden, and that was a big event. And the New York Post, with nothing else to write about, got wind of it and started calling around, telling different police representatives and policemen, hey, did you hear Bruce Springsteen's written a song about the Diallo case and saying that you guys shoot innocent people? And I'm sure that what happened was that he called five or six cops and got no response, or didn't get a response that was going to make a headline. He finally got somebody, misinformed him what the song was about, got the guy to say some real nasty things about Springsteen, and that became the headline. Springsteen attacks cops, cops attack Springsteen.
It ain't no secret.
Some people booed it when we played it, you know. But I think it was pretty well understood once we started playing it. And you know, there was a call for the police boycott, and that didn't happen with the show. Once again, my take on it was simple. Well, let me play it, and then you can cheer it or boo it. And you know, some people booed it. And, you know, I felt the song was well written. And at the time, I just let it speak for itself.
Look, it's a powerful song that touches on race in America, which is always going to put people into a defensive crouch. But as far as the controversy, it was only controversial for the newspapers.
The Rising, Springsteen's latest album, is his most commercially successful record since the heady days of Born in the USA.
Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind. Make my way through this darkness. I can't feel nothing but this chain that binds me. Lost track of how far I've gone. Far I've gone, how high I've climbed. On the backs of 60-pound stones. On the shoulder, half mile of line. Come on up for the rising. Come on up, lay your hands in line. Come on up for the rising. Come on up for the rising. The house is moaning. Bells are ringing.
people really absorbed this particular record, you know. The first night people just knew it, you know, they knew the songs, they knew the words. There was an absorption of the record. The audience felt very hungry for the music, and so that made it very satisfying because, you know, it was just something we came out, we play probably 3/4 of the record during the night and half the show is new music. And at this point down the road, you know, 25, 30 years or however long we've been hacking at it, you know, that's exciting. It's exciting to come out and see your audience galvanized by something you just wrote and you just did, you know. That's been a whole lot of fun, a whole lot of fun, and revitalizing for the band, you know.
Here's Billy Bragg.
Springsteen is one of those artists like Bob Dylan, where you try and look for the new Dylan or the new Springsteen. Springsteen is someone who's taken the form that I work in, which is singer-songwriter, and brought it to a different level, to a greater level, to sort of, in some ways, gone beyond just being a singer-songwriter, like Madonna went beyond being a pop singer, and actually be someone who is able to, in some ways, distill the spirit of the times. And I think you could look back and say that about the 1980s, but that would be A, a cliche, and B, wrong, because the new album, The Rising, for me, was the first album really to address the world we live in post-September 11th. If I was someone who'd been directly involved in September 11th, lost someone dear, been in New York at the time, I mean, to hear a song like You're Missing, it must be, I mean, it moves me.
Shirts in the closet, shoes in the hall, mama's in the kitchen, baby and all. Everything is everything. Everything is everything. But you're missing. Coffee cups on the counter, jackets on the chair, papers on the doorstep, but you're not there. Everything is everything. Everything is everything. But you're missing.
Safraz Manzoor.
Cometh the hour, cometh the man. And I think it's interesting that Springsteen hasn't really been figuring on the cultural radar since Born in the USA, really. I mean, he's been around, he's been making music, but apart from his hardcore fans and what have you, he hasn't really sort of been right at the center for a while. And I think it took something like 9/11 for people to rediscover him, because they realized that this is actually a really valuable thing that he does, which is speak to people with better nature, which is to try and sum up the mood of a country.
Pictures on the nightstand, TV's on in the den. Your house is waiting. Your house is waiting for you to walk in. For you to walk in. But you're missing.
The Rising's a really good record, and like all Springsteen's records, it's confusing to the fan at first because it doesn't sound like any of his other records. You know, I mean, Darkness on the Edge of Town was confusing for the same reason at the time. The press has jumped on the notion that The Rising is an album about how we've dealt with 9/11, with the tragedy of the World Trade Center and all that happened that day in America. And of course, there's a lot of truth in that. But I think that it really has resonance with people because it's an album about how we deal with death and how we think about loss, how we get up the next day after a tragedy, how we deal with the empty place at the dinner table. That's universal. There have been a lot of songs about 9/11, but this album is getting to people in a deeper and more sustained way than any of those did, because ultimately I think it's a record people will pull out when there's a death in the family to get them through it.
Bruce Springsteen is still as vital a performer as ever. For a fiercely loyal audience, he is the complete artist, one who can rock them, move them, and inspire them, and often all at the same time. Sitting proudly in that audience, Billy Bragg.
The redemption that you can get from popular music is one of the most important things, of all the things you can get from it. And on this album, Springsteen is summoning it all up. I think City of Ruins, to me, is just so simple. But the first time I heard the intensity of him saying, rise up, I was driving a car with my son, and I was pretty iffy because my eyes were starting to mist up, and I was thinking, this is really powerful. There's nothing you can do with him but join in and shouting, you know.
There's a blood red circle on the cold dark ground, and the rain is falling down. The church door's thrown open, I can hear the organ song, and the congregation's gone. My city of ruin.
Springsteen is of the magnitude as a cultural lightning rod, if you like, that he can speak in a voice that resonates with the American people. And in the times that we live in presently, where the American people are getting a very bad press because of the actions of one group of men within the White House, we need to connect with people like Springsteen and his constituency and remember that the majority of Americans are good, well-intentioned people who now live in a world they don't understand that's changed irrevocably since September 11th.
Anytime you're being creative, you feel it's just part of the way that you lift yourself up, you know. It's why writers write, you know. I mean, writers write because it's like you're hungry, you know. You have a need to make sense of things yourself. Probably first off, you're not really thinking, man, I got to make sense of this for this guy. You're not really thinking that. You're thinking, oh, I got to make sense of this for myself is the first thing that you think about, you know.
Now there's tears on the pillow, darling, where we sleep.
If you can't do that, then there's no way you're going to be able to make sense of it for anybody else. And the magnitude of the event wasn't something you could come in and make sense of. It was too bottomless. You could come in and maybe try to do what you could do in some fashion. That was some small piece of it or something that you felt connected to, because we lived in a community where it hit right home and there were many people lost in town. And it was right there all around you, and every day you passed the church, there were funeral. And so it was a thing where I think I tried to take some small experience of it. It was just really living through it like everybody else and writing down what came out at the time. You know, my music has been my own life preserver, and you reach for it and go, you know, so.
It ends up falling down to people like Springsteen to summon up and articulate those deeply held beliefs, that deep sense of hurt and pain that they're bound to have from September 11th, but also that urge to build the world and make the world a place where what happened on September 11th never happens again, not to anybody, not Americans, Britons, Iraqis, Israelis, Palestinians, anywhere. And that, to me, is why Springsteen is important, is because he is able to articulate that ambiguity about the American dream. And at a time like now, when so much misinformation is flying around, the voice of Bruce Springsteen, I think, is really, really crucial.
Bruce Springsteen's recording career is now 3 decades old, and from Asbury Park, New Jersey, through to the horrors of September 11th, he's come full circle and detailed every possible emotion. It's impossible to predict where he'll go next, but the journey, as always, will surely be eventful.
We are calling, and we're looking for a response. That's the gospel thing, you know, the whole idea of revival, and music can do that. It revives, and we come out at night with that idea, you know. This is a catharsis is going to occur, and that idea is just a powerful part of the evening, and we do. We try to reach in and grab people by the spirit and pull them up and make them laugh and, you know, do silly things and have fun and just the whole deal. You know.
Maybe once I thought I knew everything I needed to know about you. Your sweet whisper, your tender touch. But I didn't really know that much. Jokes on me, but it's gonna be okay. If I can just get through this lonesome day. Lonesome day.
I don't write from the outside in. I can't sit down and say, oh boy, I've got to write about this right now because this is important. Or I never really work that way. You know, I always work from the inside out. I got to be in the middle of it myself in some fashion.
I don't think there's any accident that the times when Springsteen has been most off his time have been times of great sort of change. I mean, the early 80s with Reagan and the idea of Reaganomics and the economic casualties of the recession needed Nebraska and it needed Born in the USA in some ways, I think. And I think that, again, with 9/11, America needed somebody like Bruce Springsteen to speak for it, and as ever, he delivered.
I appreciate more now. You don't have that struggle you're going through to try and make it, or concerns about, is the song as good as it's going to be, and is there any way we can fix this song to make it better, and how's it going to go over with the audience? And those things are no longer part of the equation. You're playing songs that you enjoy playing. They are what they are. Most likely people already like it, and you're now either rearranging it or just enjoying it.
Better ask questions before you shoot. Just see the trails.
My audience may have been looking towards me to once again do what I've hopefully I've done in the past, which is just assist them in thinking about those things and moving through their emotions about those things. That's kind of what I've done through a large part of my work life, and so that's a part of the dialogue that I have with my fans.
Bruce Springsteen and American Life was produced for BBC Radio 2 by Unique, the production company.